Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am going to cover in this audio Exodus chapter 28, verses 1 through 43, the priestly garments. Our context is this. Moses is on the top of Mount Sinai. He's been up there for 40 days. He's being up there for 40 days and 40 nights, and God is telling him how to build the tabernacle, its furniture, and the associated regulations involved with the Levitical worship. And so now we start with Exodus. Well, in our last chapter, let me give you the context. In the last chapter, Exodus chapter 27, verses 1 through 21, the whole chapter, we looked at the bronze altar, the courtyard, and the oil for the lamp in the holy place. So now we begin in verses 1 and 2 in Exodus 28. Then bring near to yourself, this is God speaking to Moses, so bring near to yourself, bring near to you, Moses, Aaron your brother and his sons with him, from among the sons of Israel to minister as priests to me. Aaron, that's the brother of Moses, Nadab and Abihu, the sons of Aaron, Eleazar and Ithamar, also the sons of Aaron. Nadab and Abihu are the two oldest. Verse 2, you shall make holy garments for Aaron your brother for glory and for beauty. Now notice that Aaron's honor passed down to his descendants. Moses' honor as leader of Israel did not pass down to his descendants, as John Gill points out. Adam Clark says that God's command caused Moses to establish a priesthood outside of Moses' descendants, and Moses was very obedient and humble to do that. He wasn't on a power trip. Now, this arrangement kept priestly and royal authority separate. There was a separation of powers, to use modern constitutional terminology, because absolute power corrupts and corrupts absolutely. And so now we've got the priesthood and the executive leadership of Israel separated out between Moses and Aaron. Now, God is looking for people to minister as priests to him. What is the purpose of priests? I can think of three here. First purpose, to offer gifts and sacrifices for sins. Hebrews 5:1, for every high priest taken from among men is appointed on behalf of men and things pertaining to God in order to offer both gifts and sacrifices for sins. That's mainly what we think of. Some other purposes. Purpose number two, to deal gently with those who are ignorant and going astray. Hebrews 5:2 says this, he, that's referring to every high priest, he can deal gently with the ignorant and misguided, since he himself also is beset with weakness. The third purpose of a priest is to read the law of Moses to the people, to remind them of their covenant obligations. We see in Deuteronomy 31, 10 through 12, this principle illustrated. Then Moses commanded them, saying, at the end of every 7 years, at the time of the year of remission of debts, at the Feast of Booths, when all Israel comes to appear before the Lord your God at the place which he will choose, that would be Jerusalem, you shall read the law in front of all Israel in their hearing. Now, the year of the remission of debts is the yearly Sabbath, happens every 7 years, debts are forgiven, creditor can't foreclose on his debtors. And this happened at the Feast of Booths when they came together. Then the priest would read the law to all the people there. Verse 12, Deuteronomy 31, assemble the people, the men and the women and children and the alien who is in your town, so that they may hear and learn and fear the Lord your God, and be careful to observe all the words of this law. We see this idea of priest reading the law to the people at the rebuilding of Solomon's temple, which was destroyed by the Babylonians, and then as the Israelites came back from exile in Babylonia through the courtesy of Cyrus, the Persian emperor, they came back and they rebuilt the temple. Nehemiah says this in Nehemiah 8, 2 through 3. Then Ezra the priest brought the law before the assembly of men, women, and all who could listen with understanding on the first day of the seventh month. He read from it before the square which was in front of the water gate from early morning until midday, in the presence of men and women, those who could understand, and all the people were attentive to the book of the law. An oral reading that lasted from early morning until midday. It took a long time to read the Torah. This was an oral society, of course. A lot of them probably couldn't read. They read it to the people, the priest did. Now, previous to Aaron, the eldest man in each family performed the priestly duties, as John Gill and Adam Clark say. And interestingly enough, Moses had also been a priest. We look in Psalm 99, verse 6, and read this. Moses and Aaron were among his priests. Moses is explicitly said to be a priest. We also know from Deuteronomy 18, 18 that Moses was a prophet. God shall raise up a prophet like me, referring to Jesus. So Moses is a priest, and he is a prophet, and he is basically the king of Israel. He's the leader of Israel. Now, Nadab and Abihu, the two oldest sons of Aaron that are mentioned here, They later died for offering unauthorized fire before the Lord. Leviticus 10:1-2. Now Nadab and Abihu, the sons of Aaron, took their respective fire pans and after putting fire in them, placed incense on it and offered strange fire before the Lord. And that strange fire means fire that was not constituted according to the Levitical regulations that God had given. They did it wrong. Probably did it like the pagans did it. They did it wrong, strange fire which he had not commanded them, and fire came out from the presence of the Lord and consumed them, and they died before the Lord. Sounds like fire came out of the Holy of Holies. It could be lightning from heaven, I don't know, but anyway, they got toasted. So he who has rank has much responsibility, so Nadab and Abihu were set to inherit the high priest of Israel, and they blew it and got killed for their efforts. Now verse 2 says, you shall make holy garments for Aaron your brother. Holy garments. Holy, of course, means separate from the world and consecrated to God. These garments were not holy because of any intrinsic character of the garment, as Jameson Fawcett and Brown points out. Rather, the garments were holy because of the special occasion in which they were worn. And, of course, most of this chapter is going to be about the wearing the high priest garments which he wore on the Day of Atonement. And, of course, that was a very holy day. Now, these garments in verse 10 are said to be for glory and for beauty. The NIV says to give the high priest dignity and honor. It's amazing to me how much clothes affect the way people are observed and treated. You see all these scoundrels off the street who are arrested and they have to go on trial. And what's the first thing their attorney tells them to do? Puts them in a three-piece suit. They don't even look like the same people when they go up there in front of that jury. You ought not to judge a book by its cover, but people do. And lawyers know that. And that's why they dress their guilty defendants up to make them look like little Lord Fauntleroy. But at any rate, these priests, they might have been ordinary people, but when they were doing their godly duty, they were going to be glorious and beautiful. We go down to verses 3, 4, and 5, Exodus 28. You shall speak to all the skillful persons whom I have endowed with the spirit of wisdom, that they make Aaron's garments to consecrate him, that he may minister as priest to me. These are the garments which they shall make, a breastpiece and an ephod, and a robe and a tunic of checkered work, a turban and a sash, and they shall make holy garments for Aaron your brother and his sons, that he may minister as priest to me. They shall take the gold and the blue and the purple and the scarlet material and the fine linen. First of all, verse 3, you shall speak to all the skillful persons whom God has endowed with the spirit of wisdom. They have to be skillful because this was not an ordinary task. All the fine woven blue and purple and scarlet patterns and the gold and all the stuff that they had to do here, they had to have a... They had to do some gem work, too, with gemstones, all kind of. They had to do gold work, silver and gold fillets. I don't know about silver, but gold fillets, not fillets. Sounds like steak. They had to make gold fillets. They had to do a lot of weaving and embroidering, so they had to be skilled. Now, they were endowed with the spirit of wisdom. That doesn't mean they had a temporary spiritual endowment that they could do these natural things. It means they were skillful all the time, as Adam Clark said. And that brings out this thing about the spirit of wisdom. That word spirit is a little bit loose. I mean, you hear a lot of charismatics say that guy has a spirit of nastiness, or he has the spirit of prophecy, or it means he's just kind of has an attitude of, he's got a characteristic of. That's a real loose term there, and I think that's what it means here. He's got a characteristic of, an attribute of wisdom, that they make, that these skillful people make Aaron's garments to consecrate him. The high priest had to wear these garments in order to do his work. Consecrate means dedicated to God, and once they're dedicated to God, they've got to be wearing their garments. Ezekiel 42:14, when the priests enter, then they shall not go out into the outer court from the sanctuary without laying there their garments in which they minister, for they are holy. So as soon as the priests left the holy place, they took off their holy robes and laid them in the outer court. And I'm sure the Levites put them away somewhere. They shall put on other garments, continuing with Ezekiel 42:14, they shall put on other garments, then they shall approach that which is for the people. In other words, the common activities of life. The garments were holy. They were only to be used in the temple. Now, all these garments that I mentioned, I read them to you. I'm going to be talking about them one by one as the chapter unfolds, so I'm not going to go through them right now. Notice in verse 4 that these holy garments are for Aaron, your brother, Aaron, your Moses' brother, and his sons. We're going to see there's a distinction in the clothing for the high priest and for the common priest. I'll point that out when we get to it. Now in verse 5, it says they, that means the skillful people who are going to be working with all of this, shall take the gold and the blue and the purple and the scarlet material. Now, we've talked about blue and purple and scarlet over and over again in the previous chapters. There was a large linen cloth that was laid over the wooden frames of the tabernacle. It had blue and purple and scarlet cherubim in it. Then there were two veils inside the tabernacle, one at the entrance to the Holy of Holies, one at the entrance to the holy place. And those veils were blue and purple and scarlet. The inner veil said to have cherubim woven, embroidered in the screen, in the curtain. The outer door doesn't say, but all three of them had blue and purple and scarlet. It doesn't say that they were cherubim. It does say the outer door had blue and purple and scarlet. So all three had blue and purple and scarlet. So this is a theme that's all the way through, because even the high priest is going to have blue and purple and scarlet. These are the colors of royalty, God the King's colors. And gold is added too. And of course, that's pretty much a symbol of royalty too. And of course, that gold is gold thread, which is embroidered in the material. Now, John Gill says that not only was the gold thread put into the various articles of clothing, such as the ephod, the girdle, the breastplate, and so forth. Well, the breastplate wouldn't be gold thread. That'd be solid gold. But the gold was also beat into thin plates, or it was drawn into wires. You had twisted cord. We're going to look at a twisted gold cord. We're going to see a gold fillet, which is the setting for the onyx stones on the high priest's shoulders. So gold's going to be used all through this description here, all through these garments, and we'll see as we go through. Ezekiel 39 verse 3, which is later on, we read this: then they hammered out gold sheets and cut them into threads to be woven in with the blue and the purple and the scarlet material and the fine linen, the work of a skillful workman. So when they finally got to work on this, you see that there were threads and there were gold sheets hammered out. Now, how did you get blue and purple colors? And scarlet is probably like a dark purple. Scarlet is close to purple. Blue and purple and scarlet are very close to each other, actually. Came from the Mediterranean shellfish, primarily the murex, as the NIV Study Bible says. The dyeing industry was so important in the ancient Near East, and it was mainly led by the people in the Levant, the northeastern corner of the Mediterranean Sea, along the shores of present-day Syria and Lebanon. That dyeing industry was so important that it gave the Promised Land two famous names, both of which mean land of purple. Canaan means land of purple, and Phoenicia means land of purple. The scarlet, according to the NIV Study Bible, came from the eggs and carcasses of a worm called Coccus ilicus, and that worm attached itself to the leaves of a holly plant, and they would get that worm, smash it up, make some red dye. And the red and the purple and scarlet were threads of yarn, which were dyed and then interwoven into the linen. We go now to Exodus 28, verse 6. They shall also make the ephod of gold, of blue and purple and scarlet material, and fine twisted linen, the work of the skillful workmen. Now, what is an ephod? Well, it's used for two meanings in the Old Testament. One meaning is it was an unidentified object of worship. For example, in Judges 8:27, Gideon made it into an ephod and placed it in his city Ophrah, and all Israel played the harlot with it. There, Gideon made all the spoils that he had delivered to himself in his battles, and he made an ephod. Well, that's obviously not something you wear. Some kind of a idol. It became a snare to Gideon and his household. But we're not interested in that definition. We're interested in the ephod that the priest wore. It was a sleeveless vestment worn by the high priest, just like you see in the sleeveless vestment today. There was a front and back of this ephod. The front and the back were held together by shoulder straps that went up and down from the front to the back over the left shoulder and up and down from front to back over the right shoulder. It was the outermost garment of all, put over the robe, the blue robe, which we'll look at in a minute. It was a short garment reaching to the loins of the buttocks, according to Gill. Now, we'll say this, that some people say it was a long garment that went from the waist down. It just depends on who you talk to. Depends on how you interpret the language. James Fawcett Brown says this ephod was destitute of sleeves, retained its position by the support of straps thrown over each shoulder, just as I said. We're going to look at this in greater detail later, but just as a preview here, let me read James Fawcett Brown. These straps, connecting the one with the back, the other with the front piece of which the tunic was composed, that means up and down over from the front to the back over the left shoulder, each shoulder, These straps were united on the shoulder by two onyx stones. Right at the top, right on top of the shoulder, you got two onyx stones serving as buttons under which the names of the 12 tribes were engraved and set in golden encasements or settings. And that's the top of the ephod. Then at the bottom of the ephod, it's tied together by a girdle or a waistband about a handbreadth wide. It was wound twice around the upper part of the waist. I don't know if Jameson Fawcett Brown know that, but it was a waistband round around the waist to hold the ephod together at the bottom. So it's held together by shoulder straps at the top and a waistband at the bottom. Notice in verse 6 it says, "They shall make the ephod of gold, blue, purple, and scarlet." That gold is gold threads that are wound through the linen just like the blue and purple and scarlet yarn is. We go now to verses 7 and 8 of Exodus 28. It, the ephod, must have two shoulder pieces attached to its two edges so that it can be joined together. The artistically woven waistband that is on the ephod must be of one piece, according to the same workmanship of gold, blue, purple, and scarlet yarn, and a finely spun linen. Now, these shoulder pieces I've already told you about, they went from the armholes to the shoulders. As you're looking up, let's say you got a side profile of the high priest, you look at his armhole, which is from the bottom of the armhole all the way up to his shoulder. That's how thick it was, according to some people. And of course, it was on both sides. The strap, the shoulder piece went from front to rear, and they joined at the shoulders with two onyx stones. They were different from and attached to the ephod. Some say that the workmanship was the same gold, blue, purple, and scarlet as the ephod. Others say that the workmanship was plain. Nobody knows. According to Adam Clark, however, I read in verse 8, well, that's right. The waistband was of gold, blue, purple, and scarlet yarn, but that's not the shoulder pieces. Well, you figure since the waistband looks like that, and the ephod is gold and purple and gold, blue, purple, and scarlet, you'd figure the shoulder pieces would be two. People disagree on that. The scripture is not clear. We go now to Exodus 28, 9 through 12. You shall take two onyx stones and engrave on them the names of the sons of Israel, six of their names on the one stone and the names of the remaining six on the other stone, according to their birth. As a jeweler engraves a signet, you shall engrave the two stones according to the names of the sons of Israel. You shall set them in filigree settings of gold. You shall put the two stones on the shoulder pieces of the ephod as stones of memorial for the sons of Israel. And Aaron shall bear their names before the Lord on his two shoulders for a memorial. Now these two onyx stones, according to John Gill, will have to be very large to hold six names of tribes. Either that or the names of the tribes are very small. But relatively big, I would say, only on the high priest's shoulders. They are the names of the six, and we don't know which six tribes are on which stone. Nobody knows that. It does say that the names were engraved according to their birth. So John Gill says that means the six eldest were on the right shoulder and the six youngest on the left shoulder. I don't know how he knows that. Probably from later Jewish regulations. Verse 11, God tells Moses, as a jeweler engraves a signet, you, Moses, and that doesn't mean Moses personally, it means Moses will have it done with a jeweler, you shall engrave the two stones according to the names of the sons of Israel. You shall set them, the onyx stones, in filigree settings of gold. Now, what's a filigree? That's a piece, an ornament made of fine wires that are wound together in an ornamental pattern. Here's dictionary.com says, a filigree is, quote, delicate ornamental work of fine silver, gold, or other metal wire. So basically, it's a construction of gold wires. That's where the onyx stone was set in. Now, Aaron would carry these two onyx stones on his shoulders as he goes into the Holy of Holies on the Day of Atonement. This would symbolize the fact that the high priest represents all of Israel when he ministers, because he carries their names right on into the holy place, into the Holy of Holies. Now, verse 12 says that these names will be carried before the Lord on the high priest's two shoulders for a memorial. Memorial means to bring to mind something. Well, who could be having something brought to their mind? Three options. It could be the Israelites. John Gill says the Israelites could be reminded of the merits of their ancestors. But no, Gill says many of the works of their ancestors were embarrassing to remember, so it's probably not it, and I think Gill's probably right there. Well, who else could be memorialized or reminded of something? It could be Aaron the high priest is reminded to pray for the 12 tribes, John Gill suggests, and Adam Clark affirms that that's what it is. As a memorial, as a reminder, Aaron, pray for the 12 tribes every time you go in to see God. Another option is that God is memorialized. God is reminded. To remind God of his covenant promises to Israel, as John Gill suggests. Could be both. We're going to remember to pray to God, and God's going to remember to keep his covenant promises. A memorial. The onyx stones. We go now to Exodus 28, verses 13 through 14. You shall make filigree settings of gold and two chains of pure gold. You shall make them of twisted cordage work. The them there is the two chains of pure gold. And you shall put the corded chains on the filigree settings. Well, I've already talked about the filigree settings of gold for the onyx stones. Let's talk about these two chains of pure gold, twisted cordage work. Twisted cordage. I don't know how a chain can be like a twisted cord. Some people say that, as John Gill says, that what we're looking at is a rope. Golden wires were twisted as the chains in a rope. But unfortunately, it says two chains of pure gold. Again, that's translation. NASB and Holman Christian Study Bible both have chains. Well, maybe you've got the links of a chain that are twisted around, just like you see a chain that's twisted. That's the way I picture it. Of course, nobody knows for sure. What were those two chains for? Well, they were hooked to the filigree settings, which were around the two onyx stones. And the chains fell down the front chest of the high priest from those filigree settings because they are going to eventually hook up to the breastplate, which we'll talk about in a minute. Those two golden chains are going to hook directly into two golden rings on the top two corners of the breastplate. We go down to Exodus 28, verses 15 through 16. You shall make a breastpiece of judgment, the work of a skillful workman. Like the work of the ephod, you shall make it of gold, of blue, purple, and scarlet material, and fine twisted linen you shall make it. It shall be square and folded double, a span in length and a span in width. Now, this breastpiece of judgment, the NIV and the Holman Christian Study Bible translated a breastpiece for making decisions. So a judgment is making decisions. In the NASB, it sounds like the breastpiece is bringing judgment on somebody like lightning or something. No, it's a breastpiece of judgment for making decisions. And that's because the Urim and the Thummim were in the breastpiece. And we're going to talk about that when we get to verse 30. But basically, the Urim and Thummim was some kind of a device to help the high priest make decisions, to give judgments, for example, legal decisions in a particular case. Let me read Deuteronomy 17, 8 through 9. If any case is too difficult for you to decide between one kind of homicide or another, in other words, is it premeditated or is it manslaughter, between one kind of lawsuit or another, or between one kind of assault or another, being cases of dispute in your courts, then you shall arise and go to the place which the Lord your God chooses, i.e. Jerusalem. So you shall come to the Levitical priest or the judge who is in office in those days, and you shall inquire of them, and they will declare to you the verdict in the case. In other words, you're going to use the Urim and Thummim to handle difficult situations that you can't figure out. So this Urim and Thummim was to remind the high priest that he was to do justice and to give judgment. What's right and what's wrong? We'll talk about the Urim and Thummim later. So hold your curiosity. I always thought the Urim and Thummim was kind of a strange thing, but we'll look at that in a minute. This breastpiece is made of gold, blue, purple, and scarlet material. Fine twisted linen. Gold is gold, blue, purple, scarlet, and twisted linen is white. So those are the colors you should think of. Gold and white, blue, purple, and scarlet. Now, it should be square and folded double. If it's folded, that means it's some kind of cloth, although I imagine it's thick, stiff cloth. It's got all that gold wire in it, gold thread in it. The square is a symbol of perfection, as we even say today, a perfect square. As John Gill points out, it's a symbol of perfection. It's doubled over. Why was it doubled over? Well, because there needed to be put something in the middle, namely the Urim and the Thummim. Probably. John Gill says some people say it could be the name of Jehovah written on something. Yeah, maybe so, but I think it's the Urim and Thummim. Exodus 28:30, which we'll get to in a minute, says this: You shall put in the breastpiece of judgment the Urim and the Thummim, and they shall be over Aaron's heart when he goes in before the Lord. And Aaron shall carry the judgment of the sons of Israel over his heart before the Lord continually. So that's why the breastpiece was double, to hold the Urim and Thummim. It also had to hold the weight of the 12 stones that were on the breastplate. I don't know how heavy they would be. John Gill says that because it had to be doubled over to handle those 12 stones, that might mean that there may have been nothing in the middle, because it would not have been necessary to double it over to hold something if they weren't the 12 stones. But since there were 12 stones, the doubling over was to handle the 12 stones only and nothing else in the middle. But I don't believe that. I believe the Urim and Thummim. It says right here in Exodus 28:30, you shall put in the breastpiece of judgment the Urim and Thummim. So there it is. That's where it was. I don't know why Gil says there might not have been something in the middle. Now, how big was this breastplate? 9 inches square. A span, which is about 9 inches, or half a cubit. A span, if you stretch your hand out, a man's hand from the tip of his thumb to the tip of his little finger as he stretches out his hands. If you look at it, I'm looking at my hand right now, it's just about 9 inches. So you're talking about a relatively small square. We go now to Exodus 28, verses 17 through 21. You shall mount on it, the breastplate, 4 rows of stone. The first row shall be a row of ruby, topaz, and emerald, and on the second row a turquoise, a sapphire, and a diamond, and the third row a jacinth, an agate, and an amethyst, and the fourth row a beryl, and an onyx, and a jasper. They shall be set in gold filigree. The stones shall be according to the names of the sons of Israel, 12 according to their names. There should be like the engravings of a seal, each according to his name for the 12 tribes. Now all these 12 stones are listed out with all their beautiful names. It's impossible to exactly know what each stone is. I have gone through this so many times and nobody knows. There is no consensus on all these, how to translate these stones. Here's what Adam Clark says. There is a great variety of interpretations of them, both among Jews and Christians, and they seem to be little known. Well, that's true. So we're not going to worry about that, but I will say this. They're very colorful. If I had to guess, ruby's red, topaz is yellow, emerald's green, sapphire is blue, diamond is bright white. So you see all these different colors. I got a nice picture here which you can't see. Each stone had the name of a tribe engraved on it. So not only did the high priest carry the names of the 12 tribes into the Holy of Holies on his shoulders, he also had them on his chest, close to his heart, if you will. Now, the names of the 12 tribes of Israel, I see the 12. It's interesting. You look at the list of the 12 tribes of Israel, and they're not the same in different places in the Bible. I learned this the hard way, studying something else. What can change the names? Well, Levi, for example, wasn't given an inheritance. That knocks him out. And then you got Joseph divided into Ephraim and Manasseh. So it depends on whether you list Levi or not. There's some other variations too, which I can't think of off the top of my head, but the names are not listed for certain, but it doesn't matter. The point is they stand for Israel. Gill and Clark say it is speculated that the names are written according to the birth order of the 12 patriarchs. That wouldn't surprise me. We go now to Exodus 38, verses 22 through 25. You are to make braided chains of pure gold cord work for the breastpiece. Now, these are the two chains I was telling you about previously. Verse 23, fashion 2 gold rings for the breastpiece and attach them to its 2 corners. That's the upper 2 corners. Then attach the 2 gold cords to the 2 gold rings at the corners of the breastpiece. That's the 2 upper corners of the breastpiece where the 2 gold rings are. Attach the other ends of the 2 cords to the 2 filigree settings, and in this way attach them to the ephod shoulder pieces in the front. Now, these 2 rings can drive you crazy if you let them. There are 6 of them. They're going to be 6 gold rings. Now, the first 2 gold rings are at the top of the breastpiece, which is carried on the front of the ephod. There's a gold chain, twisted gold cord, or chain, that runs from these top 2 corner rings of the breastplate, and they run up the shoulders to the left to the right, up the chest, up to the shoulder, up to the filigree setting of the onyx stone. So that's the top. That's what holds the top of the breastpiece. Now, since we're talking about rings here, and since it's going to get complicated about these rings, I'm going to give you a preview and a summary of the 6 rings. I've just mentioned the 2 at the top corners of the breastplate that are attached to the twisted cord golden chain that run up to the onyx stones on the shoulders. That's 2 rings. Now, the second 2 rings are at the bottom corners of the breastplate. On the inner fold of the breastplate, it's folded double, remember? At the bottom corners. And then there's 2 on the ephod, not the breastplate now, but the ephod itself, which is under the breastplate. And these 2 are located somewhere below where the shoulder pieces hook into the ephod and the waistband. Doesn't say where, but somewhere between the seam where the shoulder piece hooks into the ephod. That's the topmost extreme of where it could be. And the bottom extreme of where these 2 rings could be is where the waistband is. Below the seam of the shoulder piece in the ephod and above the waistband. Now, how far below the shoulder piece that these 2 rings are, that determines where the ephod was worn. Remember, I told you there's a split of opinion. Some people say the ephod was worn around the top like a jacket. Other people say it's worn around the waist and the legs like a woman's apron, or like an apron or like a skirt. I will say this in verse 27, which we haven't gotten to yet, but let me drop down here. It says, these 2 rings are to be placed on the front of the ephod close to the place where it is joined. In other words, where the shoulder pieces join the ephod. Well, if you're going to make the two rings there, that makes them pretty high. And since they're so high, you wonder how they can be of use in being joined together with the two bottom rings of the breastplate, which are going to be low right above the waistband. Well, I've thought about this. I haven't read this in a commentary anywhere, but it seems to me that even if the rings are very high up on the ephod, they can still be tied to the bottom rings of the ephod and the bottom corner rings of the breastplate. And so the ephod rings are holding up the bottom rings of the breastplate, and that would still support the breastplate, and that's not a problem. Of course, if you say that the ephod is a tunic and that the shoulder pieces come way down right above the waistband, and you got the two golden rings on the ephod between the waistband and the seam of the shoulder piece, then the ephod would have to be worn like a dress. And maybe that's why people disagree on how the ephod is worn. But I don't think that you can tell either way, because these gold rings that are sewn into the ephod, they could either be up high, the shoulder piece could just, the seam of the shoulder piece in the ephod could be high up on the chest, or it could be down there toward the waist. Doesn't matter. The point is that you got six rings. Let me go over them again. And before I do that, the two rings on the ephod are tied to the bottom two rings of the breastplate with a blue yarn, a blue cord. So let me go over them again. You got two rings at the top corners of the breastplate. They're attached by a golden chain to the two filigree settings of the onyx stones on the shoulder. Then you got two golden rings at the bottom of the breastplate, and they are attached to two rings that are sewn on the ephod with a gold cord. We go down to Exodus 28, verses 26 through 28. You shall make two rings of gold and shall place them on the two ends of the breastpiece on the edge of it, which is toward the inner side of the ephod. Now, these are the two rings on the bottom of the breastplate, which I've gone to a great deal of trouble to explain. I'm not going to spend too much time here. 27, verse 27, Exodus 28. You shall make two rings of gold and put them on the bottom of the two shoulder pieces of the ephod, on the front of it, close to the place where it is joined. That's the seam, the two rings on the ephod that I've already told you about. It's between the seam of the shoulder piece in the ephod and the waistband. That's verse 27. Verse 28, they shall bind the breastpiece by its rings to the rings of the ephod with a blue cord. Again, I've already talked to you about that. So that it will be, I'm not even going to read the New American Standard Translation. It's so horrible here. I'm going to read the Holman Christian Study Bible translation of verse 28. The artisans are to tie the breastpiece from the rings, that's the bottom rings of the breastplate, the two bottom corner rings of the breastplate, to the rings of the ephod with a cord of blue yarn, so that the breastpiece is above the ephod's waistband and does not come loose from the ephod. We go down to verses 29 and 30, Exodus 28. Aaron shall carry the names of the sons of Israel in the breastpiece of judgment, or decision-making, the breastpiece for making decisions, over his heart when he enters the holy place, for a memorial before the Lord continually. You shall put in the breastpiece of judgment the Urim and the Thummim, and they shall be over Aaron's heart when he goes in before the Lord. And Aaron shall carry the judgment of the sons of Israel over his heart before the Lord continually. I've already mentioned what that might be a memorial of, a reminder to Aaron to pray, a reminder to God to keep his covenant. Now, what are these Urim and Thummim? I promised you I'd talk about that a little bit. NIV says that the probable meaning of the Hebrew is the curses and the perfections. Urim is the first letter of the Hebrew alphabet, Aleph. Well, Urim begins with the first letter of the Hebrew alphabet, which is Aleph. And Thummim begins with the last letter of the Hebrew alphabet, which is Tau. And Urim probably means curses, and Thummim probably means perfections. So, but what were they? Well, here's option number one, and that's the option I believe it's going to be. There's some wild speculations about this. The NIV Study Bible says they were sacred lots often used in times of crisis to determine the will of God. Numbers 27:21 says this, moreover, he shall stand before Eleazar the priest, who shall inquire for him by the judgment of the Urim before the Lord. At his command they shall go out, and at his command they shall come in, both he and the sons of Israel with him, even all the congregation. This is referring to Joshua, and Joshua's going to get judgment for some unknown decision he needs to make. He's going to go to Eleazar, the priest, and Eleazar's going to ask the Urim, which is short for the Urim and the Thummim. Now, the idea is that there was some kind of lot in there. Who knows what it is, some kind of a stone or something. Let's say a white stone or a black stone. If you picked up the black stone, that means, oh, that's the Urim, and that means curses. So the answer is no. If you picked up the white stone, that's Thummim, and that means the answer is yes. It means perfections, and so the answer is yes. That's the NIV Study Bible's idea. I'm making up the idea about the lot, the stones. Here's what Adam Clark and John Gill say. Most interpreters are at a loss to know what they actually were. And here's some options, the sacred lots options, which is the option I like, because it's less speculative than all these other ones. Here's option number two. The words Urim and Thummim were written, placed in the breastpiece. So they were written on a piece of stone, say, and then put into the breastpiece. And so then you picked out Urim or you picked out Thummim. Again, that's similar to a sacred lot. Some people say they were little images like teraphim, little idol images. I don't think so. Some people say it's the same as the 12 stones. John Gill and Jameson Fossen Brown mention this option because wherever Urim and Thummim is mentioned, there's no mention of the 12 stones, and vice versa, when 12 stones are mentioned, there's no mention of Urim and Thummim. Well, if that's the case, then how the stones were used is a mystery. Maybe the stones sparkled in such a way, says John Gill. Maybe they made an inward impression on the mind of the piece. Maybe on the mind of the priest. Maybe the priest heard an articulate voice from God. Well, that's just so speculative. I don't believe that. Adam Clark says maybe the Urim and Thummim were nothing material. Maybe it was a mystery delivered to Israel by the mouth of God. Well, this is called 4th down and 20. Let's punt. Nobody knows. I think sacred lots is the best answer. That high priest just reaches into his breastplate and says, is it going to be the black stone or the white stone? Ooh, Urim. That's a curse. Bye-bye. No, your answer is no. We go now to Exodus 28, verses 31 and 32. You shall make the robe of the ephod all of blue. Now, this is the blue robe that goes under the ephod. There shall be an opening at the top, at its top, in the middle of it. Around its opening, there shall be a binding of woven work, like the opening of a coat of mail, so that it will not be torn. So picture, if you will, a sheet, except it's a blue sheet, and there's one hole in it, like you used to put on when you were doing Halloween stuff, and you want to be a ghost. You cut a hole in the sheet and put that hole over your head. That's kind of what this thing is, except it's blue, not white. It was to be worn under the ephod, of course, as the NIV Study Bible says, and it was longer than the ephod. And all the pictures you see on the internet all have it that way. Ephod's on top of the blue robe, so it's kind of a background blue. Adam Clark says it's one long straight piece of blue cloth with a hole or opening in the center for the head to pass through. That's what the hole was for. It had a binding woven around the hole to strengthen the sheet so it wouldn't be torn. Remember, this sheet's got to hold the ephod's on top of it, the breastplate's on top of that. I could see why it might be torn. Now, this is distinguished from the ephod because the blue tunic is a solid piece of linen. Well, it doesn't say linen, does it? That's interesting. Well, let's put it this way, blue cloth. But the ephod was not a solid color. It had gold, blue, purple, and scarlet. The tunic didn't have woven work in it, but the ephod did. It had a bunch of figures and characters in it, probably cherubim. There are no seams anywhere in the blue robe, but the ephod had seams at the shoulders. Jameson Fossen Brown says this blue is a sky blue. Now, how he knows that, I don't know. At any rate, the woven binding around the headpiece, around the head hole of the blue robe, that blue robe had to hold up the ephod, had to hold the shoulder pieces of the ephod, and also the breastplate. So it had to be sort of strong. Exodus 28, verses 33 through 35. You shall make on its hem, this is the blue robe, on the blue robe's hem, pomegranates of blue and purple and scarlet material. Where have we seen that before? Those are the three royal colors. So the pomegranates were blue and purple and scarlet. Think about this. We got pomegranates that are blue and purple and scarlet. We got an ephod that's golden, blue and purple and scarlet. We got the top linen cover of the bottom linen cover of the tabernacle frame, blue, purple, and scarlet. We got the two screens inside the tabernacle, blue, purple, and scarlet. We got the, I think that's all. You see the pattern all the way through this, blue, purple, and scarlet, the royal colors. So all around its hem, you got blue and purple and scarlet pomegranates and bells of gold between them all around. A golden bell and a pomegranate, a golden bell and a pomegranate. In other words, we got a golden bell, then we got a blue pomegranate as we're going around the hem of the blue robe. A golden bell, then a blue pomegranate. A golden bell, and then a purple pomegranate. A golden bell, and then a scarlet pomegranate all the way around the robe. Verse 35, it shall be on Aaron when he ministers, and its tinkling shall be heard when he enters and leaves the holy place before the Lord, so that he will not die. Now, this tinkling, of course, comes from the bells that are on the blue robe. There's a Jewish tradition, as the NIV Study Bible points out, that one end of a rope was tied to the high priest's ankle. The other end of the rope remained outside the tabernacle. So the high priest would go in and to the Holy of Holies, not the holy place, but the Holy of Holies on the Day of Atonement and do his work. If the bell stopped tinkling, that means the high priest screwed up and was struck dead. And so then the rope could be used to pull the high priest's corpse out of the holy place, and nobody else would have to go in there and also die. If the bell stopped tinkling because the priest was taking a breather or for whatever reason quit working, the people would gently tug on the rope, and if the priest was still alive, he would start moving around again, and the bells would tinkle. Well, that's nice. That's not in the Bible now. That's in Jewish tradition. So let's look at some options of these bells on the robe, on the hem of the robe. Option number one, the tinkling would let the people know that the priest was doing his work. And this is what I think it is. The majority view is this. They could pray while they heard the tinkling because they know the priest is serving God. The Cambridge commentary says that the bells were such that the purpose of the bells was so the worshipers outside might know how long to follow with their devotions. In other words, when the bell stopped ringing, they could stop praying. Kylan Delitzsch says this is hardly correct. I don't know what Kylan Delitzsch thinks is correct. Here's what Ellicott says, quote, "The great object of the bells was to make known to the people by a sensible manifestation every movement of their representative, every act that he performed on their behalf. The bells enable them to follow in their thoughts the entire service that he was engaged in, to join their prayers and praises with his, and offer to God a common worship." Well, I think that's reasonable to me. The people heard the bells, they prayed. Here's another option. Adam Clark says, "A bell is rung in the ancient Near East when a supplicant approaches a king. And so therefore, since the high priest is approaching the king, he's ringing the bell." Kylan Delitzsch says that this is a quote-unquote trivial explanation. Well, maybe so. I think that the answer is that this is just so the people could know that the priest is working and they could follow along and pray until the bell stopped tinkling. He's got to have the blue robe and the bells on so that he will not die. Now, some people connect the dying or the possibility of dying with the bells being heard or not. I think the best, a lot of commentators say no, it's talking about the blue robe. He's got to have the blue robe on, because if he has the blue robe on, he's going to have the bells, so they go together. So we don't need to focus on the tinkling of the bells as having something to do with him dying or not, as whether he's got that robe on. You just don't walk into God's presence unclothed or improperly clothed. If you do, you're toast. The application of that to modern day life is obvious. We walk into the Holy of Holies without the blood of Jesus and without being clothed in the pure linen of the saints, as John puts it in Revelation. We are also toast. Exodus 28, verses 36 through 38. "You shall also make a plate of pure gold and shall engrave on it, like the engravings of a seal, holy to the Lord." So picture, if you will, a golden, pure gold nameplate, if you will, or a badge. And engraved on that badge are the words, "Holy to the Lord." "You shall fasten it on a blue cord, and it shall be on the turban, and it shall be at the front of the turban." Turban hadn't been mentioned yet, just mentioned in passing, but it's a turban on the priest. "It shall be on it, the breastplate shall be on Aaron's forehead." Now that's a little confusing. That sounds like the breastplate is right there on Aaron's head and on his forehead. No, that's not what it means. It means at the front of Aaron's, it's not at the back of Aaron's head, it's at the front of Aaron's head, although it's a little bit higher than his forehead because it's on that turban. "Aaron shall take away the iniquity of the holy things which the sons of Israel consecrate with regard to all their holy gifts, and it shall always be on his forehead so that they may be accepted before the Lord. Holy to the Lord," this nameplate says. This engraving made the focus of the law explicit, as Adam Clark says, because what is the purpose of the law, the focus of the law? God is holy, and you're to be holy as I am holy. The law required holiness, as Adam Clark says. Its aim, design, and end was holiness, as Clark continues to say. Holy means sanctified, which means separated from the world and dedicated or consecrated to God. The high priest will take away the iniquity of the holy things which the sons of Israel consecrate, verse 38. How? Well, maybe the offerings weren't lawful. Got the wrong animal. You got a defective animal. Something like that. Or maybe the matter and the way the offerings were made was not lawful, didn't sprinkle the blood in the right place, whatever. You do something wrong, the high priest shall take away the iniquity of that holy thing, the iniquity of that sacrifice which was offered wrongly. It's kind of confusing at first because it says Aaron will take away the iniquity of the holy things. Well, how can the holy things be full of iniquity? They're contradictory. It means because they weren't presented right. Now this nameplate that says holy to the Lord shall always be on Aaron's forehead. That means always when he was in the tabernacle doing priestly things, of course, because when they went out of the tabernacle, they did not wear the priestly robes. They laid them down as they walked out of the holy place. When they got to the outer courtyard, they laid those garments down and didn't wear them anymore when they were doing normal stuff. We go to Exodus 28, verse 39. You shall weave the tunic of checkered work of fine linen. Now, I'm in the NASB translation here. You shall weave the tunic. A tunic is something different than the robe we just talked about. You shall weave the tunic of checkered work of fine linen, and shall make a turban of fine linen, and you shall make a sash, the work of a weaver. Now, the tunic, according to the NIV Study Bible, was worn under the robe, but above the linen undergarments, which are going to be mentioned in verse 42. So we have so many clothes here. I'm going to give you a review and preview and a summary of all of his clothes of the high priest. First of all, going from outer to inner, you got the breastplate, which is on the ephod, which is on the blue robe, which is on top of the tunic, which is on top of the linen undergarments. So we're talking about the tunic now here in verse 39. It says that the tunic is checkered work in the New American Standard Bible. The Holman Christian Study Bible says it's just a tunic, which doesn't make any sense to me because I'm not an expert on the translations and I don't know the Hebrew. I looked up in Wikipedia. Wikipedia says it means embroidered, an embroidered tunic. This would be contrasted with the tunic of the ordinary priest, which tunics were plain. Wikipedia cites verse 40, which says absolutely nothing about the ordinary priest tunic being plain. So I don't know where they get that from, but I assume it's true. So we've got a checkered tunic, embroidered tunic. I assume it's got that same blue and purple and scarlet pattern in it, perhaps. Now, this verse also mentions a sash, the work of a weaver. Remember, sash is not the waistband that holds the ephod together. That has nothing to do with that. Waistband's a waistband. A sash, let me read what a sash is, according to Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown. It is said to have been very long and being many times wound round the body. It was fastened in front and the ends hung down, which being an impediment to a priest in active duty, were usually thrown across the shoulders. Sounds like a Roman sash. This is not in the scripture, by the way. I assume it came from Jewish tradition. We go now to Exodus 28, verses 40 through 41. For Aaron's sons you shall make tunics, you shall also make sashes for them, and you shall make caps for them for glory and for beauty. You shall put them on Aaron your brother and on his sons with him, and you shall anoint them or ordain them and consecrate them that they may serve me as priests. Again, this is God telling Moses to do all this when he says you. It's talking about Moses. You, Moses, shall make sashes for them or have them made. Now, the sashes, the purpose of the sash was to gird up the long tunics to make it easier to do the work of the priest. So the sash would be wound around, grab a hold of the tunic, and then the sash would be thrown up over the shoulders and around the shoulders and will hold the tunic up, just to hold the tunic up so that the priest could walk around easily. The ordinary priest, in verse 40, we're going to have caps made for them. The NIV translates that as headbands. I don't know what they looked like, but they were glorious for glory and for beauty. And by the way, it is possible to get too puritanical about getting rid of images in church, and pretty soon you end up with a meeting house that's got whitewashed walls. There's nothing wrong with something being beautiful, folks, just as long as you don't worship it. And unfortunately, given the state of American Christianity, there's a lot of Christians in this country that want to worship their church building. But if you're going to build one of those things, and I don't advocate it, you at least ought to make it beautiful as much as you can and not ugly, which most of them are. Verse 41, you, Moses, shall anoint them, putting oil on the priest, as were prophets and kings, prophets, priests, and kings, well anointed, symbol of the Holy Spirit coming on their heads. You shall anoint them and ordain them. Ordain just means set them up into their ministry. And consecrate them, it means dedicate them to God, that they may serve me as priests. Actually, putting the garments on was the ordination. When you ordain them is when the priests were put on during that ceremony, and the anointing with oil. So dressing them in their robes, anointing them with oil was their ordination, and they were ready to go as priests. We go now to Exodus 28, verses 42 and 43. You shall make for them, that's the ordinary priest, linen breeches to cover their bare flesh. They shall reach from the loins even to the thighs. Sounds kind of like, not boxer shorts. Yeah, like boxer shorts. Not the briefs, but the men's underwear that have little pant legs to them, because it goes from the loins to the thighs. They shall be on Aaron and on his sons when they enter the tent of meeting or when they approach the altar to minister in the holy place, so that they do not incur guilt and die. Approach the altar, I assume, is the golden altar, because they've entered the tent of meeting, and that's where the golden altar is, to minister in the holy place. That means to snuff the wicks, trim the wicks, put the coals from the bronze altar on the golden altar of incense, change the bread out, that kind of thing. They had to do all that stuff. They had to wear their linen breeches so that they do not incur guilt and die. Serious thing. If you get your underwear, you lose your life. It will be a statute forever to him and to his descendants after him. John Gill says the purpose of these linen undergarments were to preserve decency, to prevent immodesty, and to guard against laughter and levity. I guess somebody saw a priest's private parts hanging out. That would tend to make people start laughing, would it not? Of course, I don't know. He's covered up with all these robes. I would imagine he would be pretty modest and decent, but I guess there is an exception, though. If you walk upstairs, you can look under all those robes, kind of like a woman's dress. And when a woman walks upstairs, you got to be careful. Same thing with these priests. They walk upstairs and people could see. So there was linen undergarments. Adam Clark says, pagan priests, by contrast, often ministered naked. Verse 42, when it says, you shall make for them linen breeches to cover their bare flesh. That bare flesh is referring to their private parts. This is the tent of meeting, of course, which is the tabernacle, because that's where God met his people. More precisely, it was in the holy place where the seven flame candlestick was, as I've already mentioned. Now, this statute that they should wear linen breeches, and I assume it refers to all the caps and the robes and all that was mentioned earlier, all the regulations concerning the priest would be a statute forever. Now, that's forever means as long as the Aaronic priesthood continued. It doesn't mean forever and ever and ever, world without end. Because obviously we don't have priests anymore. In fact, we didn't have priests when Christ abolished the priesthood and he became our high priest. Ladies and gentlemen, we have now finished this difficult chapter of Exodus chapter 28 concerning the priestly garments. That prepares us for our next audio, which will cover Exodus chapter 29, the consecration of the priest. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, as I hope you have enjoyed this one.